at Transition Towns. And we're going to start with a short interview which just with someone called Lewis. About the town of Lewis. I'm sure a man called Lewis once lived there. Transition Town Lewis. So we're going to kick off with that, and afterwards we're going to have some discussion about it and the varying issues surrounding that. That'll be done with Duncan. We've got a couple of other cool things on today. We have some reports from different gates, a little bit of cop report, and because of Latin America Day, we actually have some reports in Spanish as well, so stay tuned for them if you habla español. Alan's doing an interview with the Bolivian Solidarity Campaign, which will be wicked. We also have some music, and we have a really good media report, which is covering different aspects of mainstream media towards the camp. So keep it tuned.
Okay, so that's some of the sounds from the front line of Climate Camp 2008. We're here, there's a group of protesters holding a line for the last few days, and we're here beside the police who are on the other side of the line. I'm here with Adrienne Campbell, who's involved with Transition Town Lewis. So could you tell us a little bit about this Transition Town movement, please?
Well, the whole movement started less than 2 years ago in Totnes, when a guy called Rob Hopkins decided to see whether he could get his community to create positive action for a better future with far less fossil fuel, which is, of course, what is in danger of extincting us.
Okay, and what sort of principles does it use, or strategies, or?
Well, it's based on the idea of an energy descent away from fossil fuels, a gradual and managed and planned and creative and ingenious energy descent across all sectors of life within our communities. So, for instance, with food, what would it take to live on very, very little fossil fuels, say, in 20 years' time? How could we produce our food? What would that look like, smell like, taste like? You know, and what would that involve? What are the steps that we would need to get there? So Transition Towns are about creating small positive steps towards fossil fuel-free for future, but also coming up with an energy descent plan, a 20-year plan to get off fossil fuels. So there are about 600 communities around the world now, just within 2 years, coming up with these ideas. And I'm involved in Lewis, which has been going for a year and a half, and we've already had some incredible stuff that's been happening. Lots and lots of people, 600 people involved.
Okay, and that's people, was that from established communities before, of like green activists or eco-heads or hippies or whatever, or is it a very mixed kind of community that are participating in this?
Yeah, it's very mixed. It came out of the blue, out of nothing essentially, and it formed from, say, about 15 people, none of whom really knew each other. Just for this common aim, but also it's really important to work with the groups who've already been doing a lot of groundwork for this, both campaigning but also positive actions. So yeah, we're trying to work with all the different groups.
Okay, and what sort of, for example, to kick it off, like how did a few people say, oh, let's just do it, and then publicise, or could you tell us how it grew?
Yeah, the main way it happens in most communities, and there are 12 steps, actually, that's now sort of there's a way to do it that's described in Rob Hopkins' book, but also online, 12 Steps to Transition. You just form a call group of like-minded people, or you just might start with one person, then just call a meeting to see who turns up. And then you spend a few months just raising awareness of the issues, climate change and peak oil, and then after that...
And that might be like films, talks with speakers, or...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, inspiring speakers, films, yeah, the lot. And then there's this wonderful thing called Open Space, which is like a community think tank where you can get together and talk around issues. It's very, very egalitarian and inclusive.
Is that something that happens everywhere, or just in Lewis, or...?
Well, we've done about five of them in Lewis, but it is one of the 12 steps, is to do open space events.
And what, just to, like, where does it happen, or how do people...
Okay, well, what we did with the core group was we found a venue and a date and a time and place, and and then we figured out what the question was. So one of the open spaces was called, how will Lewis feed ourselves in a life with far less fossil fuels?
Okay.
And so given that question, we invited very widely, and whoever turned up, were one of the principles are whoever turns up are the right people, whatever happens is the right thing, and you can move about. What happens is you start in a big circle and people just come forward with bits of paper saying, I want to host a meeting about orchards or beekeeping or community supported farm. Then you put them up on a grid of times and places within that space over the day, and within half an hour, you've got your day's workshops all sorted out, and then the whole thing just runs itself without facilitators. It's a really egalitarian way, and then you come up with masses of ideas that can then feed towards the way, you know, the way that you're going to come up with solutions.
And one of the things, just from listening to this excellent phenomenon, which seems to just grown so greatly in Britain especially, is the kind of sense of empowerment that people have, because a lot of time people feel, I'm aware that there's this environmental crisis, but I just don't know what to do, and I don't feel that there's any option. I don't think we can change it. Whereas this transition town seems to offer one way that people can just easily get involved and then start doing it, and with that start to really feel that massive change can happen and will happen.
Absolutely. Rob Hopkins says that we can use our sort of collective ingenuity. It's not that anybody has the answers, but together we can, with creativity and courage, we can come up with the answers together. And I think that's the big thing, is doing it together, because that is so more powerful than feeling like you're on your own and you're powerless. Mm-hmm. Actually, we found in the last 18 months we can do tremendous things. In fact, in a month we're going to launch our own currency in Lewis, which has had international press. Everybody's incredibly excited about it, and the local brewery is coming up with a brew called the Banker's Draft.
Brilliant.
To celebrate the occasion, and we've got Barclays Bank are going to actually issue the Lewis pound. So there's like quite creative stuff going on there.
And just one of the ideas that, like, in recent years that we've seen a decline in community for whatever reasons. But is this something which is bringing back that community and that sense of connectedness and ideas and just celebration and making new friends and knowing each other and really having deep, profound experience of living with people?
Yeah, totally. I mean, many of us didn't know each other before this, but we have created a community. And it's not just the people doing it. It's about recognising that in the age of oil that we've just really gone through, the big age of oil, and that we're coming to the end of the age of plentiful tea oil. We have broken a lot of our relationships. A lot of the relationships that were in place over you know, generations have been broken because of this sort of globalization and the disparities in wealth and the fact that we no longer respect our local producers, farmers, traders. We don't recognise that they are an integral part of our networked and community, which creates resilience and happiness and mutual support. And I think transition towns have the opportunity to reconnect all of those broken ties. And we're re-networking ourselves within our land, within our relationships with each other. It's subtle, but it really essential thing.
And then, for example, some of the proposals that you've made, like, for example, has there been proposals or actions to make new gardens or to bring in certain policies?
There's lots of initiatives around growing. I mean, we're holding an open edible garden thing this autumn. We did a celebration of local food just a few months ago, and we were working with local farmers to talk about how we're going to feed our community in an age with much less fossil fuels. Yeah, lots of things, both practical and also theoretical. Lots of discussions and practical actions, starting up car clubs and creating community bags and working with schools, creating little films together. And
what's just on that, like, what's been the kids' kind of participation or idea about it? Because I think it's getting the kids involved and them actually driving many things is a huge part of all these processes.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the kids are really excited about it. They've got far more vision than the adults because they're much less, you know, prevented on sort of the yes but factor that we've all grown up with. But my sort of feeling about kids is that actually we are the generation that's really fucked up this planet. We've really kind of used it far beyond its capacity. And actually we are the generation that has to make fundamental change within our own life. And, you know, the wealthier we are, the more privileged we are. And that's why I think Lewis is a really important place to be making the transition, because it has got some very privileged people there. I think that, you know, we are the ones that have to sort of start to make amends for the damage that we've done so far. And also to remember that life with less oil is going to be, in many ways, a lot healthier and happier and more resilient and a much better kind of life than the life that we've created so far.
And I think, like, apart from all the positive things that this is doing, like increasing the joy in community, making it more beautiful, making more excitement, which are amazing things in themselves, but the really critical thing is, like, if we don't make these changes, that if this model of how we live at the moment keeps on going, our species will die. That's the critical thing about this.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We've got everything left to lose.
Yeah, so... Anyway, listen, so hopefully see you soon and, I don't know, eating an apple up in Lewis or something. Oh, actually, one last thing. Could you tell us about the film?
Yeah, there was this great film that was made right at the beginning of Transition Town Lewis by a young guy called Keith Ellis. And he just went out with his camera and he was interviewing the people on the street saying, well, what do you know about climate change? And so, and then he's done this little rap at the end of Everything is Made of Oil. And he put it together within a couple of days. That was just something he wanted to do, and he put it online, and it's gone around the world and inspired lots of people.
And it's brilliant.
Yeah, look up on the Transition Town Lewis website. It's really funny. Mm. Yeah, it's great.
But then it got played because it's only 3 minutes or something. Yeah. And it got played before all the main films or something.
Yeah, we got the local cinema to play it in the months before the launch, the unleashing of Transition Town Lewis. We got the local cinema to play it before the films, and that was pretty impressive too.
Excellent. So, and then just I've been asking people just their last message to all the people in the world.
Yeah, just come to Climate Camp, and if you can't come to Climate Camp, just start to make a stand about what you love. And you know, if you love life and if you love this planet, then start to make a stand. Everybody has to start doing this.
Lovely, thank you very much.
There about the transition towns, which is really taking off here in Britain, and it's doing a lot of good things. So we're here in the Climate Camp radio station, and it's been a bit chaotic, but hopefully we'll all enjoy this. So there's a lot of people here in the tent who are going to talk about transition towns and other examples of how we can move forward and make the world a sustainable world, far different from the way it is at the moment. So first of all, I'd like to introduce Kim, who's part of the site here, and talk about the principles behind the site, how it's working.
Hi. I've been involved with Climate Camp for a couple of years now, doing site stuff. Okay, sorry, adjusting the microphone. We try and keep everything as low carbon as possible, but obviously it's just an experiment so far, so there's a lot of things that need to be developed, and there's a lot of things we're doing really well, and there's a lot of things that really do need improvement. There are a lot of different examples of how we reduce our carbon emissions, or how we tried to do that. One example would be we get all of our electricity from solar panels, wind turbines, and bicycle powered sound systems, and there's some bicycle powered internet phone connections. We also use as little electricity as possible, so we have a curfew at 11 o'clock when we shut all of that down except for minimal lighting. We use compost toilets, and we try and reduce all of our waste as much as possible, and then whatever waste we have, if it's compostable, it gets composted. If it's recyclable, it gets recycled. We also have grey water systems, so we're not and we're saving all of the nutrients that would be washed away into the ground, and they get extracted through filter systems, and then they get composted as well. We try and reduce water as much as possible. We have solar powered showers, which is kind of a black bag that heats up in the sun. So it's a really simple mechanism, and we use those if it's sunny enough. If not, we use bucket washers. We have the toilets, we separate everything, we send all of the solid waste off to be composted with a farmer, and then all of the urine goes onto straw bales, and then they're also sent off to be composted. We try and source all of our food locally. We use as much organic as we can afford, and all of our food is vegan, which is the most sustainable diet that you can eat. It's something that every individual can do in their everyday life to massively reduce their carbon emissions.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. And I think there's a couple of thousand people on the camp at the moment. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So and mostly there's some big tents. There's some smaller tents. And when we leave, there'll be no rubbish left.
Yeah. We hope to leave to feel better than it was when we got here.
And after a lot of lovely things happening here.
Yeah.
So some of those principles seem very low tech and you know seem very easy to do. It's people might say, oh, well, sure, yeah, that's a lot of people out in the field. But the thing is that these principles can be used and on the more macro levels. We can take this to wider communities, to villages, to towns and to cities. So the thing is with this discussion to look at how we do that and then try to do it. So now we're going to hear about a great example of an eco-village, Bedzed, and Cara's going to talk about that.
Hello. I'm fortunate enough to work in the Bedzed development. The Bedzed development is really, it's like the opposite end of the spectrum in some ways from what the climate camp is, in that it is a genuine attempt to enable people to live in a really, really low carbon way, in a really, really low waste way. But it was achieved by building new homes and offices, by doing that in a mainstream economy, in the sense that they were built by a housing association, so the kind of organisation that normally builds houses, and that some of them were sold on the open market and rented and so on. But it's true that some of the principles that you can do on a really low-tech scale were also employed at Bedzed, and it's also true that some succeeded and some leave room for improvement. I'll give you a couple of examples if you want. So the first thing is when you build new, you just insulate the hell out of your building so that you don't lose lots of heat, and then you try to make sure that your energy comes from solar, the same as it does here, and that your heat comes from wood, ideally, that's been sustainably sourced. And that is what happens on the site through just much more high-tech ways of doing it. And then because there's other things that are to do with trying to make that accessible to people who aren't keen environmentalists. So we've got like 2,000 really keen environmentalists on site, but not everybody is ready to do that yet. Compost toilets being a really good example of what some people can't face. So we've just got commercially available really low water loos that look not like normal loos.
Okay. Well, from there, we've got another person involved with the Transition Town Network. We've got Jody, who's been working in Brixton. So could you just tell us a little bit about your experiences with this Transition Town?
Hi there. We set up Transition Towns Brixton 16 months ago. Before that, we were there was about 10 of us doing Lambeth Climate Action Group. And we heard about the Transition Town method and thought that it had a lot of potential, and there was just a really inspiring methodology. And so we did it. So we changed our name to Transition Towns Brixton, and we started the first step of the transition process, which is the awareness raising, and started throwing these events and trying to get the message out. Over the last 16 months, we've managed to attract nearly 1,000 people in Brixton. That's in South London, to sign up, and probably about 50 active people who have formed groups. Like we have quite an active economy group that's had a through a economy conference last month, which was economy day. Basically, it wasn't a conference in terms of professional conference. It was a day for local people to explore how we could relocalize our or look at the sort of systemic problems within the economy that we're driving, you know, unsustainable lifestyles, and look at how we could try to relocalize the Brixton infrastructure. And about eight other groups, like food, transport, education. And so we're working towards our local energy descent plan, and having our unleashing on the 2nd of October, I think, in Lambeth Town Hall.
Okay, great stuff, and best of luck. Just a little bit about where I'm coming from. I've been working in Banja Luka in Bosnia, in a war-torn zone after the Bosnian War, where they set up an eco-city group a few years ago as a try to push an exploration about what are eco-cities, and we end up exploring it, putting an exhibition into an art gallery, and just getting a discussion going. It didn't really take on too much further. From that, back in Dublin, we proposed a 18-kilometre ecological corridor for the city, a ring around the inner city, linking along the old canals, Europe's largest urban city park, the Phoenix Park, and all the waterways of the city. We did bike rides along this. We tried to connect the communities around there, a lot of which went through disadvantaged areas, which with a lot of crime and problems in the past. We also set up community gardens on a few of those points along there, because we are interested in looking at the idea of food, because food is one of the major ways that you can alter the sustainable lifestyle, I suppose, or whatever. But if you grow local and start making the cities produce food for the city's people, that's one way. It's a very good example has been what's happened in Cuba when they went through a peak oil system, when the failure of the Soviet bloc in 89, suddenly there was no oil to power their systems of food production. It was a crisis. Millions would have died very quickly unless they altered their ways of production of food. They produce food locally in any spots of green. They started planting food, organising it, giving it out between themselves, or organising markets for selling of it, etc. It was a decentralised network which came away from the centralised system of the communist government of Cuba. But the result is now 6% of the food, of the fruit and veg of Havana, is coming from the city. So we are trying to explore, could that be done in Dublin? And we just kicked it off, and that the first garden is grown, and it now exists. With a couple of hundred people have come and participated. It's in Dolphin's Barn, and it's rocking, and it's got a lot of good things going. I'm based in Barcelona at the moment, and we're looking at Barcelona being pushing for it to look at the ideas of it being an eco-city. So, for example, using a roof space as a solar collector, water sorter, green roof system for insulation, using that system to have less dependence on potable water, because Barcelona has a water crisis at the moment. Water is coming from Marseille across the sea in boats. 2 years ago, half of the world's population moved into the urban environment. That's people, for whatever reasons, we'll go into that later, that have moved into cities. A lot of it is in the developing world, shanty towns in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia. Stuart Brand and another guy's, I can't remember his name, have some views about that that's actually a very good thing. That's similar to the medieval system of how towns grew that led to Europe and the Western world's situation. You can check that out later on. I'll talk a bit about cradle to cradle philosophy from William McDonough. He says in the nature system there is no waste. We basically design stupidly. We need to radically reimagine our design system and start building systems that are sustainable. So basically you break stuff into organic and non-organic nutrient systems. So for example, your compost goes back into the cycle, blah blah blah, food grows, you eat it, blah. But also with the stuff that we have, that goes into stuff, and it's not recycled, but it's continually upgrading. So buildings can be constructed, deconstructed, built up, etc., as opposed to just getting all the plastic, melting it, and turning it into benches, because if we do all that, it ends. So we have to become smarter. He's gone from designing shoes to chairs to buildings to, at the moment, 12 plans for 12 eco-cities in China because of the massive housing situation that exists in China at the moment. Curitiba in Brazil is a very good example, where in the 60s, Jamie Lerner looked at the city and, with very limited budget, thought about the problems outlined them and came up with smart solutions to the problems. And a lot of it was about engagement, working with community, getting people involved, planting loads of trees, getting kids involved, getting kids taking ownership of the trees and the spaces, etc. And Curitiba is now probably the best example of a sustainable city in the world. At the moment, in Masdar, in the middle of, I think, Abu Dhabi, maybe someone can correct me on that, there's plans to build a new sustainable city, which they plan to be the model sustainable city. Foster, Norman Foster, is involved with that. And there's lots of systems, car-free zones, no food production, water, etc., etc. So that's just a little bit. So now, that was the first part of this. There's a few more people who haven't spoken, so we might have a full idea of the model of what we're trying to get, but I think we've a little bit more of somewhere where we might try to want to go to. And that's very essential, because I think we really need to think further and further and imagine what is that built environment of tomorrow. How do we live? What are the systems in place? That's an ongoing system, and it requires constant critical discussion. That this is part of all that. So the second part of this talk is we'd like to just open up and look at ways of which we can actually get towards that model. That, so be it climate camps, be it actually, maybe Chris, maybe you might talk a little bit about what your plans of how you might change the world.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm organising a zero carbon caravan. We're going to travel around without using any fossil fuels. We're going all around Europe. We're going to end at Copenhagen for the 2009 climate talks, which are absolutely key because they're deciding what happens and when Kyoto Protocol ends in a few years' time. We're going to be demanding a zero carbon world, and we'll be going around proving that it is possible. We can look at the Zero Carbon Britain report from the Centre for Alternative Technology in Wales, which has done a detailed analysis of we can get down to zero carbon in 20 years. Some people say we could do it in even less, so the point is it's zero carbon as fast as we possibly can. That's what we need. We'll be travelling around visiting transition towns, eco-villages, housing developments like Bedsted, and those sort of places, carrying the messages around, but not just telling people what to do in the towns you visit, asking them for their ideas as well. So the whole of Europe can get together, and then they've got to pressure their politicians, because it's they're the people that's going to make the decision. Come the end of 2009, we want a zero carbon world as quickly as possible.
Well, we have someone from Scandinavia here, so would you like to introduce yourself, and maybe you could add some of the Scandinavian views about this discussion, and or even how you see this camp.
Yeah, my name is Joachim, and I'm originally Swedish, so I'm not from Denmark, at which the whole meeting will take place. I feel like when I'm listening to you, it's such a shame to not have history. Like, as a Scandinavian person, I feel a lack of historiosity. Like, you speak about making transition towns, etc. Like, if you don't notice that you know so much already. So I'm, like, representing the new one here, I feel. In the sense, lower it? Yeah. Okay, thanks. So, for just making an example, I feel like I'm taking part of this, to step out of the risk to be just a consumer and at this climate camp, because it's so easy to be fascinated and romanticizing everything, and just think, as I did before I chose to be a part of this, that other people have so much more to say about transition cities, towns, which you have, of course. Should I link this to Copenhagen, you think?
Yeah, even to Sweden. What town are you from in Sweden? Or what's a kind of typical Swedish attitude towards these issues? Do they feel a sense of urgency?
Yeah, thank you, Duncan. I would say, like, the main opinion among my friends is that we feel a certain desperation to learn so much so quickly, because we need to do so much stuff soon. So I think I got a picture when I listened to you, like, we should have a science on us saying we should really be influenced, you know, like, I mean, there will be meetings before Copenhagen during the 18 months that's left, or 17th, but they really start like in 1 month from here, and I feel like it's such a different thing to be like 10 people in Gothenburg, where I live, and 10 people in Stockholm, and try to abstract how on earth are we going to bring this movement to Copenhagen. It's like, And someone goes, oh, anxiety, shit. And someone's like, oh, no, it's real. You have to take this. And then we get an email from someone saying, we have the responsibility for this. So we come here to get like body experience, to really feel it, that it's possible, etc., etc., in so many ways. Like,
well, maybe from that, I'd like to, there's a still a few more people who haven't spoken, so hopefully they might add their views soon enough. There's more people involved, previous or existing, or soon to be in more in the Transition Town network. So if we can go back to transitioning, but before that, I'd just like to add in an idea here, an idea that a US ecologist, Paul Hawken, is talking about, that as much bad stuff has gone on in the moment, and we're all aware that there's a pretty dire crisis going on at the moment, that actually at the same time there's something amazing happened, something that has never, ever, ever happened in the whole of civilization as far as we know. He calls it the immune system of humanity kicking in. And basically it's that the immune system is probably the most complex system in the human body or in other animals' bodies. And it's just there, it just sits there. But then when it's attacked or when it's under threat or when it's crisis, it kicks in and then suddenly it starts shooting around and it starts to analyze what is healthy and what is not, what will sustain life, what will kill life. And it starts to take out the bits that are destructive. And that's what cures your colds and stuff like that. But if you apply that to the idea of humanity and civilization, which is hard to do, the idea is that this what's happening here is this waking up, that somewhere that there's a radical imagination or remembering possibly happening that's coming from three strands: the social justice movement, the environmental movement, and the indigenous movement. And basically the essence of it is that we realize that our present way of living is will kill us unless we radically change it, but that with that something amazing has happened, because all these little bits everywhere are starting to bubble and come to the surface, do their own little thing. It's not one certain body, it's not one group, it's not this. It's just a whole lot of stuff happening, and it's amazing. So I'd like to throw that out and then bring it back to the idea of the climate camp, because I think a lot of people have had some beautiful experiences here, and that maybe that one of the ways that we can push stuff is the creation of these beautiful communities, like this short-term community that we're all living and part of at the moment. So I just throw that out, if anybody feels like, or maybe someone who hasn't spoken yet, if you'd like to talk or...
Yeah, okay, thanks. I was just going to make a positive contribution in terms of how I see that you could add to the energy descent plan of transition towns by adding a political element. Because as you could see in the wonderful climate camp we're in at the moment, we could use it as an example for what may happen in a beautiful future, as you just discussed, where if we had a localized economy where communities are producing their own food, which would be amazing, and critically producing their own energy, that would disenfranchise the establishment as we know it. And so we'd have some very angry, powerful people. And so the example I'd like to give is how the climate camp empowers us and thus disempowers these potentially angry, powerful people. And so the climate camp gives you a very realistic idea for how you can share ideas, become empowered, but at the same time you've got to have a slight shard of pain, because we do experience unfortunately the intimidation by the police of this state, which does unfortunately support the powerful, who have very established interests that go against the sustainable living that we're trying to promote. So yeah, that's my little positive contribution, that I'd like to see a political dimension in the energy descent plan. I think it'd be very useful. Thanks.
So maybe someone who's been involved with another transition town might be able to come back and talk a little bit about that.
I actually wasn't going to address that particular topic. I was just going to... Several things. Climate camp, I think, is great, but it is just a holiday, in a way. And although we talk about, you know, setting up a sustainable lifestyle here, it's very short term, and we have to realize that in order to really set up a sustainable lifestyle, it's going to take a lot more than, you know, a few of us in a field setting up some systems. We can learn a lot from this, but basically it's a very short term thing. But just going on from what you were saying about Paul Hawken and the NGOs, this book that he's written, Blessed Unrest, which brings together the hundreds of thousands of NGOs that are really doing such a lot of work, which is completely unmentioned in the mainstream. It's all underground, but there is, when you actually look at what is happening, there's a tremendous amount happening. It just isn't reported in, you know, in the mainstream. And also I was going to pick up on what you were saying about food, because I think food is really something that everybody really feels they can get around. And in particular in Bradford, we're going to try and set up a community-supported agriculture on some derelict allotments. And I want to mention Middlesbrough particularly, because they have had a wonderful project which is really growing food, a bit like you're saying in Cuba. The local council really were really got behind it and gave out containers to people so that they could grow food in their backyard and in the street, and wherever they could fit a container in, they started growing food. And I think that's really what we have to do, because everybody, I think, is becoming aware, with food prices shooting up, and they're probably going to get higher because energy prices are going higher, and that's going to affect the cost of food. We really have to start growing our own food. We're not going to be able to import food in the way that we do. So our whole system is going to change.
And maybe from that, it's worthy to point out now that, you know, we're not just this little group in Britain or Northern Europe who are coming together. We're part of a global movement, and we're actually the smaller part of this global movement, because it's mostly the people who are being affected by global, by structural adjustment, by the World Bank, by other systems, bringing it back to the political. There's like so much destruction going on. There's so many refugees. People are dying. There are 7 million people dying every year, and they don't need to be dying. That is scandalous. But maybe, I don't know, like, there's other examples of food in other parts of the world. No? Okay, no. Okay, well, I don't know. Well, if anybody wants to jump in or add something else, yeah? Okay. Back to Brixton.
I'd like to respond to the last comment, because I don't think that climate camp is just a holiday, actually. I think it's much more than that. It's important, and... You know, as you were saying, the Paul Hawkins' book, Blessed Unrest, he mentions actually 2 million little NGOs working away at change in so many really, really pragmatic examples of massive social change. And Climate Camp is the absolute cutting edge of that change in Britain, and it's an incredibly important chance for us to come together and really explore not what we're doing here this week, but what we're doing all year long and for the next 10 years or and longer. I don't think it's just a holiday. So and also in response to the comment about transition towns being apolitical, I don't believe that at all. The thing is, with transition towns, it's political, but it's not implicitly political. It's not upfront in its political. Angle. It's more. It's political by its nature, but it doesn't sort of use that. It tries to make it a new path from sort of traditional environmental sort of campaigning in order to attract a wider audience, and then once those people engage, then they'll naturally have to engage in politics. But it's not, and so that might put off a lot of more traditional activists. But I think it as soon as people sort of start to really wrestle with the issues, then they're going to need to get it becomes political.
Okay, so back to Chris.
Yeah, I'm the climate policy advisor to the Green Party, but I'm involved with Transition Norwich, but I
keep it, we all, I mean, one or two Green Party people involved in Transition Norwich, but we're all absolutely clear that this is a non-party political thing, so we never mention the Green Party when we're doing the Transition Town stuff. Because we might have to get people who support the other political parties on board. It's not got to be divisive. No party political point scoring. It's everybody's got to work together for the sake of humanity and the climate and the rest of creation.
Well, that's, and just, like, maybe we'll finish off soon enough, but it's just the idea, I'm very interested in the idea of what exactly is political, because I'm not sure about that. For me, everything's political. And I'm interested in, like, people have, direct action and stuff like that. Like, for example, when we set up the garden in Dublin, people were coming down to grow food. They didn't see themselves as radical activists. They just wanted to grow food, and they had a beautiful experience. They met some amazing people. But from that, for example, some people might have ended up going to talks about anarchists coming out of prison, for example, as did happen. But the idea is that, I think the idea of Transition Towns is that it can act as a springboard. And the seriousness of the problem we face needs to be confronted at all levels, and to make whatever is needed to create something amazing and so accessible, so beautiful, and so easy to just get involved. And gardens, in my experience, have been really great ways for doing that. So maybe we might finish off with...
I just wanted to come in about the neutrality of not being political, because Somerset, for example, Somerset County Council have now taken on Transition Town as their program, but they stipulated that it had to be a neutral political program. And so in that way, we can involve a lot of people who would not really otherwise come together. And I think political in that context really means just not aligned with any political party. Because definitely the steps that we're taking are really political. We're trying to get people at the bottom taking decisions about their own lives and taking their lives into their own hands. So, okay.
Okay, well, I think we're going to finish up. But the important thing is, okay, this has just been a short little talk, and it's brought a few people together in this somewhat chaotic climate camp. But the thing is that we've talked about this stuff, and from that we know a little bit more. And I think there's an absolute need for this discussion to continue and to keep on creating spaces, be they in Transition Town spaces or not or whatever. But keep on creating these spaces and let these things grow and for more people to enjoy it. So I've enjoyed this very much, and I thank everybody for their participation, and I hope that we just keep it going. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chickpea here with Brad from the police liaison team. They're a very hardworking team on site doing lots of stuff to keep in check the situation with the police. So what is going on? It seems like we issued a statement to them. They issued a statement back. We issued a statement back to them. Maybe you could give us a whole spiel of what's happened since the beginning.
Well, essentially, when we started the camp, our main aim as police liaison has not been to negotiate with the police or, you know, bow to their demands or anything, but we have tried to really work out exactly what they want from us, what do they actually want, and what are they trying to do. And the whole frustrating thing about this entire camp, unlike any of the previous camps, is we just actually don't know what the police want. They invade the site with loads of riot cops, hit people, send people to hospital, arrest people. Then 2 hours later, they clear off again, leave the site abandoned from police, and then they come in again the next morning at 5 o'clock. And it just seems very random that they've got no real aim. Last year at Heathrow, the aim was quite clear. They wanted to be on site. We had a problem with that, of course, but in the end we found a way that we could just about make it work in a way that the camp was willing to accept, and that was to have, you know, some officers patrolling around the site, and then after that things are okay. This year we got a situation where the police just seem to be, you know, acting like complete maniacs, you know, rushing in one second, rushing out the next, and so we're just trying to find out what they actually want. And the most frustrating thing is that we're just not getting that clear information off them. So what we've had the last few days is we've been passing written requests to each other, and they've demanded it in writing. They're occasionally refusing face-to-face meetings. So it's been a really frustrating, long-winded process, and all we're trying to get from them is a clear proposal. So they say they want patrols on site, and we said, okay, we can maybe accept that if it keeps the situation calm and it means we're not going to be beaten up with riot cops at 5 a.m. every morning. So we said, okay, 2 coppers on site, accompanied at all times. They rejected that and gave us no other clear proposal. We asked for a clear proposal. They give us back a page of waffle, which we can't do anything with. So finally now we've asked them yet again for a clear proposal. What do you actually want to do on site? Who do you want on site? How do you want it to be done? And then maybe we can actually start to get somewhere. But as yet, we're still waiting for that information, and as yet, we still haven't got a clue what these police want to actually do.
The situation at both gates there, perhaps you can describe it for us.
On Thursday last week, after 24 hours of complete peace, and it seemed like the most peaceful climate camp ever, the police giving us no hassle, it was the smoothest pre-camp police liaison, they were super nice to us, buying us smoothies and coffees and everything, and it was, you know, it felt like, oh wow, maybe we're losing it, maybe we don't scare them anymore, maybe we're not radical anymore. But then 24 hours later, they just turn up with, storm the police with loads of coppers, pushing everyone everywhere, completely unannounced. And the most frustrating thing was they never actually requested, since we took the site, they never actually requested to even come on the site. They never asked politely. They got a search warrant. They never even asked if they could come on the site. They just barged in, completely unannounced, without even putting that request forward. And so they came in via one of the back gates, which we're calling K5. And so our response to that, due to the, essentially, we see it as a health and safety emergency, if people are going to get battened and beaten up and sent to hospital, then that's an emergency just as much as a fire or medical emergency. So we took it to, as a camp, to block that entrance with vehicles and people. And since then, the police have, there's a constant standoff over there with the police, and they're still insisting to us through the liaison meetings they have to have that unblocked for health and safety. Now, what we're saying to that is we're not going to take advice from the police on health and safety. The kind of people who come and batten you and send people to the hospital, they're not the kind of people to advise us on health and safety. And furthermore, the exit is like miles away from all the infrastructure. The road at the front, that's where you get on the site, that's where you get onto our fire exits. All over there, a fire engine wouldn't even get down that hill. It's completely ridiculous. We know exactly why they want to get into that exit, for what they did before when they sent all their vehicles around, seized all our equipment that we needed for our essential health and safety infrastructure, and beat everyone up. That's why they want to get into that exit. So we're saying no still.
Is there anything else that you could bring up for us information-wise?
Well, essentially, we're looking now at trying to get, yeah, as I say, we're trying to just work out what the police actually want to do. We know we're probably not going to agree with what they want to do, but at least in the past, they have the courtesy to tell us what they want to do. Then we can say no, then we can even try and find some vague kind of idea that might just keep the peace for a bit. But with this lot, all they seem to want to do is, well, we haven't got a clue what they want to do. It's, you know, it just seems completely bizarre, and it's been...
Are they still blocking the council from coming in?
Yeah, sorry, I should have mentioned that. We had a council inspection due yesterday at 3 o'clock, which our kitchens team have always found very useful on our end, because obviously each time you come, it's a different site, a different setup, new people involved. You know, it's very useful to get their advice, and so we're really keen to welcome them on. Then within like 10 minutes of them due to become here, we got a call from the council saying, you can't come on. We can't come on as a council. The police have told us that it's too dangerous for us to be on site. So the police are essentially deeming this an unsafe place to be. Fortunately, an hour later, the local MP came round and looked around the site, and he actually then directly said to a news camera when he left, he's never felt so safe in all his life. So we're in a situation where we're being and I just have a situation now where the police are telling local kids that they shouldn't be coming down here, that they don't want to come down here, and that if they do, then they're going to get stopped and searched and everything. So we're in a situation where we're being completely demonised. And on one hand, you know, that's really bad, because what we're trying to do is build a movement. On the other hand, it shows that, you know, they're scared of us. We actually have the ability to create radical change. And I think finally, you know, we've been taken very seriously.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for giving us this update, and hopefully we'll get some information in the future from you.
Definitely.
Hi, Chickpea here with several locals. Am I right?
Yeah.
Who are you guys?
We live up Stoke. Our names are Connor,
Michael,
Eddie Boy,
Danny.
And you are all wearing very nice Stop Kings North t-shirts.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Who made those?
I don't know, really. They were in the thing.
Yeah, we found them from the Welcome Centre, and we was asked to model them for a little while, and yeah, I'm all for it, to be honest with you.
Wow. Great. So what do you think about Climate Camp?
I think it's brilliant. We wouldn't have come down here if it wasn't for this man here who brought us down here, and it's a great eye-opener.
Can we mention this person's name, please, because it is his well-being that we're here, so please.
Introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Brad.
Yes, and we will also be talking to him about the police liaison situation later.
Talk about that.
Yeah, the too much police talk, but so what are you guys going to do while you're here on the climate camp?
Look about, really.
Enjoy the experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
You're really all nice people, because like, the police are saying it's a completely different story. Like,
people here have had knives, and even I got searched for drugs and knives. I mean, I'm a 15-year-old boy, and I don't think that's right, but yeah.
Yeah. The searches have been really ridiculous in keeping people, locals out.
They've got like dog units and stuff like that. There's just no need for it.
Yeah. You always have to bring the dogs into it.
I mean, the dogs don't want to be out in this weather. And also, like, about the King's Knoll thing, I mean, they're going to build that new station in there. And I mean, like, you've got to think about all the badgers and that, really. Because if they're going to build that, they're going to get rid of badgers, pigs, all them sort of
fish.
Animals and fish, yeah.
It's great determination as well. It's a good experience really.
Can I big up the Chatham boys too? Quiet out to Fat Dan, out to Little Lou and all the boys.
A little shout out to the locals. Yeah. Anyway, well, thank you guys for speaking with me today, and you should drop by the radio tent sometime. Say hi if you feel like being on the radio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
And we're back live on Climate Camp Radio. I just want to give some announcements. If you are out in the fields and you want to do a recorded interview, you can call on your cell phone, and you can call the number 0207-043-3783 and choose menu number 6, and it will leave a message, and we'll get that, and we can use that for the radio. Also, some promos. This radio is brought to you by various radio groups that have come together, and those being Dissident Island, Rise Up, Flash Radio, and PlentyFact.net. And if you're looking for something to do, definitely go check out the job site, because there is always stuff to do on the camp, so definitely do your part and help out. And now we are going to go into a track in a second, but we have lots of really good material coming up for you, so actually we're going into a thing about the back gate. We're going to get an update on that situation.
A5,
yeah,
the north one, is it?
Yeah, it's the top north. One on the site.
Okay,
yeah,
thanks. And how's it been so?
Relatively peaceful, like really peaceful actually. We had the Met on. I think lots of us have been up here for a really long time, and my brain's a bit fuzzy and all this sun. But we have got some tarps strung up. So the Met got a bit angsty with the Welsh boys who came and took over, Hedlig and Blake. And not a lot of them were speakers. We had quite a nice relationship with the Met earlier this morning. Mm. It got a little bit angsty because I think they're probably trying to get round the back of the red car.
Right.
Not in any kind of nasty, aggressive way at all. They're being very, very peaceful about it. And so, yeah, we realised that after the Welsh boys came on, Welsh men and women. Their spirits have been so amazing. The food was extraordinary. Like, we had about a 10-course meal earlier on, and it was so beautiful. Like, people's spirits were raised straight away. There have been very few. We're getting so much more on it about having shift changes, and people are really looking after each other up here.
Mm.
And that just helps diffuse the situation. If the cops know that we're looking after each other, then yeah, that we're all in on it together, and hopefully with them as well, to find some peaceful solution that makes us happy and hopefully doesn't make them put their helmets on.
Great.
And that's what we're looking for.
Yeah. Like, so there's been no situation like there was this morning with the riot police?
No, we haven't had any dressing up yet. Though I think some of them look like they quite want to dress up.
Bored, aren't they?
Yeah, they're bored as hell. Yeah, they're really bored. No, we haven't had any dressing up. We've had like little scuffles that, because we're really on it now, like we've diffused really quickly over people sitting on shoes. Mm. There was this amazing woman sleeping on a copper's leg earlier today, and when the shift change came, the second shift hated that and got really angsty with her, physically picked her up and put her back. So that was the sort of worst physical stuff I've seen up here. There have been lots of sort of stepping on toes and, you know, subtle, clever little things, you know, haha, very funny. But the amount of people up here has been really important, and, yeah, relieving people around the red car has been really nice. And the atmosphere has been amazing. Like, we're getting better at this. Every day we're getting better, and it's so brilliant to see that progress. Like, it's really amazing.
And how do you think it's impacting the police?
Them
standing there doing nothing.
Oh, they hate it. They absolutely hate it. They hate anyone else's droning voice. Sometimes they lack conversation. Essex police love a bit of dirty talk. Some of the Met did earlier today. The Welsh boys aren't up for dirty talk, apart from one woman who was spooning me with her legs as I was lying on the front earlier today, which was quite exciting. She didn't give me her mobile number, but I can understand I can write to her at the main South Wales police address, which is good to know. I think we're just, my main feeling about today is however exhausted they're making us by doing these chopper flights and these false calls. Like, hear that, man. That's what it's about. It's about people being really positive about them, us talking to them. So when, as and when, if they, and I really hope they don't, get dressed up again, then we can look them in the eye and go, we were just talking about organic gardening and how you're struggling to grow basil, mate. Please don't spray me in the face. You know, I've got my hands in the air, just above my head peacefully. Please don't do that. I think we're empowering ourselves through really non-violent direct action. Like, we're doing it here, and it's working, and it's beautiful, and we're building on it, and it's permaculture, and I think it's fantastic. And it's just like all these pockets of non-violent direct action that we're doing all over the place, all over the site, just by having the workshops. In my mind, that's direct action. And yeah, the communication improvement that we're having between the main site and this gate is so much better now.
Great.
We need to keep working on it. We've still got a bit to go, but that's getting better, and that's so important. Yeah.
All right, thanks very much.
No worries, thank you.
We should deserve rest now.
Yeah.
Hey, we're back, and we've got the evening food review from Bicycology. And we're here with Miss Many Miles and Peter Pan. And they've got their meals from two different camps today, or two different barrios, rather, today. Mm-hmm. Those being?
Yeah. Well, seeing as the teapot's dinner last night was so good, we thought we'd do a kitchen off with two different kitchens. So we're comparing teapot's food, anarchist teapot food, with the Yorkshire.
I went to Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. So how's the grub tonight?
Well, should we start with the teapots? Yes. Well,
do you want to pass it over so that the presenters can taste? Yeah. What we've got is like a veg chili. Veg chili.
With rice. A brown rice, I think. Mm. And a burger, get that. A nutty burger. There's a little bit left there.
I'm scoring this, sorry.
And there's a green salad with a really lovely vinaigrette on it. And a beautiful pink root vegetable salad
that beetroot salad,
carrots,
is very
beetroots,
nice. Quite a few kitchens
celery.
Have been doing that, rocking that salad.
That's not bad.
Good
on
them, it's a nice salad.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Have you tried some?
I will, actually, because hopefully my dinner is coming from the vegan teapot tonight, so I'm looking forward to it very much.
So how does the...
It hasn't all gone by the time...
Yeah.
If we haven't sung its praises too much, and there's a huge queue by the time you get there.
Yeah, there was quite a long queue, but the servers were very cheerful and wearing a particular... And one of them was wearing a particularly nice vest.
Ooh.
They get points for that, do they?
Yeah.
Their clothing choices. We're fashion critics too now.
It's expanding.
So how does the Yorkshire grub compare?
The Yorkshire grub tonight is not so good. There was no queue at Yorkshire when I went. Well, there was a couple of people, but no queue. So I went there because I was in a bit of a hurry to get down here. There's basically like a sort of courgette-y, coconut-y soup thing, which is quite watery. Not that I'm saying that's bad. It's just a thin soup is what I'm saying. Not a thick style soup. And some bulgur wheat and a bulgur wheaty salad with toasted cashew nuts and seeds and some apple in and stuff.
Mm.
It's okay. It's not bad, but it's not hugely exciting.
Okay,
you seem to have eaten rather a lot of it, so I don't think it could be that bad.
No, it's not bad. It's not bad, but it's not last night.
last night's food was pretty good. So. I think we're going into a track now, and thank you so much for coming on and giving our evening review.
Quite all right.
It was the year 2003. A hippie with a goatee beard came right up to me. He said, "Do you like to dance?" I said, "No." Well, a longer limb friend of his are climbing up a tree. They're hanging up and down. He put the drum between his knees. He said, "Do you like to dance?" I said no. He said, "Do you like to move and dance and sing? Are you in the mood to shake that thing? Do you like to move and dance and sing? Are you in the mood to shake that thing?" Well, I looked to left and right, and then I looked straight up. I heard a coming, and I thought, man, shut up. But it was grooving, it was moving, it was bouncing more than sweet. And I started to feel a tingling somewhere in my feet. They sat me down on the ground and tried to keep my cool, but soon they were on top of me and I felt like a fool. Do you like to move and dance and sing? Are you in the mood to shake that thing? Do you like to move and dance and sing? Are you in the mood for the happiness we bring? Well, a bear cop with a violin was flipping round and round. I thought, I can't forget his look, I'd find him in the crowd. His face was white with rosy cheeks, he had a crazy chin. But the first thing that I noticed was his lovely cheeky grin. His knees were wobbling at a rate, I looked and had to laugh. I felt like I was floating out like I was on a raft. But the three of them propelled me up and set me on my pins. I felt like I had lost control of my jiu-jitsu shin. One more time they asked me, now this time I couldn't lie. If I stayed still any longer, I believe that I would die. To move and dance and sing, are you in the mood to shake that thing? Do you like to move and dance and sing? Are you in the mood for a tingling? Well, I was driving hard, now my limbs are singing free. I was jumping up and down just like I've been stung by a bee. I smiled and laughed and stopped around, I was having fun. They even let me have a go at banging a big drum. I asked them for their names and they looked at me cool. I said, hang on a second, what's this music called? It's the Brother Babska. Run and tell it to your mom. It's the Brother Babska. The Brother Babska. It's the Brother Babska. Are you bouncing? Yes, you are. It's the Brother Babska.
Yay! Bit of music, bit of ska. That was by Brothers Bab, a wicked little ska band, and Theo Bard sent that on to us. Cheers, dude. So, to continue on with a bit more of a media update about what's going on in the camp, next up we got a little piece done by Vietz, which gives us a media review of the last couple of days, but includes some very interesting mainstream media recordings, etc. So, let's take it away.
Hello there, good afternoon. Knives, makeshift weapons and bolt cutters, just some of the items Kent police say they've found
Kent
near the so-called Camp for Climate
Change. Kent police say they've drafted in 700 officers and have £1 million budget with which they're determined to stop activists closing down Kingsmill
Stand
Power
off,
Station.
Police and protesters watch and wait, getting ready for a massive march against a replacement
police
power station.
Police in riot gear have used batons and pepper spray on campaigners who are gathering outside Kingsmill Power Station.
Six arrested as riot police clash with protesters at the King's North Climate Camp. One MP condemns police tactics as aggressive.
Welcome to the Climate Camp Media Review. It's me from Rise Up Radio in Nottingham, and in this new feature for Climate Camp Radio, I'll be bringing you lies, spin and populist crap from the public airways in the Daily Digest. Now, in all seriousness, we'll be giving you some bits and bobs to listen to from the coverage the camp has been getting in the mainstream media. We'll start off with a report by Meridian TV on the 1st of August, just after the first police raid on the camp. Not speaking with anyone from the camp, but instead with the police, this report puts the emphasis on the camp's supposed criminal intentions.
A protest camp set up at the King's North power station in Kent by eco-activists has been raided by police. The Camp for Climate Action Group is demonstrating against plans to build a new coal-fired power station at the site near Hoo. Officers say they're disappointed that items from the group show protesters were intent on breaking the law. Two people have been arrested and charged with obstruction. David Glencourt reports.
This was the camp yesterday. Around 60 of the main organisers already in and planning their assault on the giant power station. We weren't allowed onto the site and had to take pictures from behind a fence. Shortly after we left, the police moved in and seized several items, including bolt croppers, padded suits, climbing ropes and super glue. The police said today it was obvious that some of the protesters were intent on criminal action.
It was a worrying development. We carried out two arrests. Two people have been charged and are now prohibited from returning to the Isle of Grain until their next court appearance, which is after the protest is due to finish.
The protesters have never shied from making their intentions abundantly clear. They've threatened time and time again to shut down the power station by what they call direct action. We had exclusive access to the power station yesterday, and there was speculation today that the protesters plan to use the bolt cutters and padded suits in an assault on the razor wire fence around the perimeter. The eco-activists are also saying they'll attack the station by sea from the Medway in boats. But today the police called this plain stupid.
If there is a flotilla planned to come in, there is a high chance that somebody could get seriously hurt or killed.
So the battle lines are drawn, 700 police officers and E.ON's own security team preparing to repel the planned mass action. The police operation will cost well over £1 million. David Glencross at King's North for Meridian News.
And here is a BBC South East news item from the same day.
Stop and search powers are now in place. Everyone coming and going is under police surveillance. These measures have been put in place after two campaigners were charged with obstruction, and equipment which the police believe could be used unlawfully was seized from the camp.
Yesterday we applied for and obtained a search warrant to search the site. The amount of material that we recovered had to be recovered in a lorry. There was that much. You know, things such as super glue, large quantities of super glue, bolt croppers, items for which protesters would use to actually chain themselves to railings.
The police have been planning this for months, and a makeshift police village and roadblocks have suddenly appeared in the area. The police presence is unmissable, and local residents can't believe the scale of the operation.
Wherever you drive, there's police up there, roadblocks, roads closed, everything like that.
I don't think they'll have much chance of breaking into the power station.
Why is that?
Because there's a security.
And that's not just down to the police. E.ON, the owners of the power station, have built a second inner security fence with razor wire, ensuring there's now two lines of defence.
Right, so that was at the start of the camp. Similar to reports of the taking of the side, really. Pretty neutral reporting with a bit too much airtime given to the police PR. Well, then come the 3rd of August, the day of the march. Various little bits in national newspapers, some with photos, but nothing too worthwhile mentioning especially. One thing did jump out, a short piece on BBC Radio Kent, which is a prime example of some appalling journalism. How about we talk to some of the protesters and ask them some really random technical questions in a bid to undermine their credibility. Listen to this from the early morning John Warnett show.
The camp is in protest at plans to build a new coal-fired power station, which campaigners say will add to global warming and blow a hole in Britain's green credentials. That's why they are there. But do they know why they are there? Our reporter Simon Longprice thought he'd asked that very question, and he joins me now. Simon, I thought it was pretty clear why these protesters are where they are.
Well, it is to a degree, as you described just above. They don't like coal-fired power stations because of climate change concerns, and they want renewable energy. But I wondered if they knew what they were actually asking for. I mean, specifically, like, whether they knew just how much energy the country needs and how that squares up with what's on offer. So I asked a number of people five questions in all, with a couple of supplementaries. And my interviewees ranged from campaigners who are local residents to event organisers. Now, the interview we're about to hear with a Kent Greenpeace member is absolutely typical of the replies I received. I asked him first just how much power the country needs on average a day.
Not exactly how much it needs, no.
If I were to say it needs, on average, about 63 gigawatts, does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, indeed, yeah, I can understand that.
How many megawatts is Kings North going to produce?
Is it 2.3? I don't know.
It's 1,600 megawatts.
Is that it? Just 1,600?
Do you know what the difference between a megawatt and a gigawatt is?
How many megawatts into a gigawatt, son? Thousands, yeah. So there's only 1,600 megawatts coming from Kings North.
The chap you just heard, really, in all seriousness, was...
Crayons, disabled access ramps, marker pens, banners, radios for relaying fire and medical emergency information, the nuts and bolts holding toilet cubicles together, and blackboard paint. They have found it necessary to use pepper spray without provocation, and several campers have been arrested and bailed off the site for obstructing increasingly aggressive police officers. Everyone who enters the site is being searched. Police officers are taking anything away that could be used for illegal activity, with efforts being made to strip protesters of such hardcore weapons of choice as bits of carpet, biodegradable soap and toilet paper. In the absence of any serious threat, the police clearly found it necessary to justify their presence with an unprovoked attack on personal hygiene.
Later on the Monday, the police try and come onto the site and eventually do so, with lots of them in riot gear, with all the unnecessary intimidation and violence. From what I can see, from then on, there is a slight change in some of the reporting, as, apart from the climate campers, for local people and journalists who are on the scene, it is very apparent that the police tactics are totally out of order. One BBC reporter ran onto the site when the police moved in. Yes, outside of the media hour. And this was broadcasted on BBC Southeast Evening News.
The police have entered through a back gate here. As you can see, they're trying to hold their ground in the middle of a field. The protesters are trying to remove them peacefully from the ground that they're camping on. To many people observing and to people camping on the site, it wasn't clear why the police had taken the action they had.
BBC Television, can I ask you a quick question? Why you came onto the field at all?
You can ask me. Whether or not I'm going to answer you is a different question.
Well, I'm asking you, why did you come onto the field?
We've come on set for the safety of the campers here.
And what was concerning you about their safety?
We had intelligence received that said we needed to come onto the site.
Currently now it seems a bit of a standoff. What's going to happen next?
There's no standoff. We're just waiting to confirm what our next actions are and we'll go from there.
For much of the day, most of the camp was peaceful. Many of the protesters didn't get involved in the skirmishes. Arthur Scargill visited the site. The former leader of the National Union of Mine Workers was used to seeing violence on the picket lines during the miners' strike of the 1980s.
Come on, no way!
I think it's regrettable if there are clashes between the police and protesters, demonstrators, because people should have a right to demonstrate and to protest in the 21st century.
Kent Online, a small local media outlet, has been doing pretty good coverage of the camp, running blogs with residents and local activists, and providing some TV and radio downloads. This is an interview with Hazel Daw, chair of the Kent Green Party.
I have had several reports from Kent Green Party members who are at the site of how appalled they are at the way police are behaving towards peaceful demonstrators. This is not acceptable. And I have written to Mike Fuller, Chief Constable of Kent, today, asking that he, as the person in charge of police operations in Kent, ensures that police behaviour is kept within operational guidelines and within acceptable levels.
Do you believe, then, that there is a relationship breakdown, then, between the police and the protesters?
I know that protesters have been negotiating with police before and during the camp. They have attempted to keep a good relationship with the police. I do hope the police will learn lessons from yesterday's violence and that they will coordinate better with the members of the camp who are trying to keep this under control, and that the police will avoid violence in future.
I mean, you've mentioned the miners' strike of 84-85. Do you really believe it's going to get to that level?
I hope it doesn't, but it is showing signs of getting to the level of the miners' protest. What I am worried about is the wider implications. If policing at the climate camp gets so violent that it antagonises people, I already have Green Party members telling me they are appalled and disgusted. These are ordinary Kent people. They have never seen policing like this. They are appalled and disgusted at the behaviour of our own Kent police. I do not want the relationship between the people of Kent and the police of Kent to break down in the way it did after police aggression against the miners during the miners' strike. I don't want to see that kind of situation arise.
Being criticised left, right and centre, the police could do with something to legitimise their actions on Monday. So what would be better than finding a stash of knives near the camp and claiming, without any evidence, that these originate from activists at the camp who have violent intentions?
Weapons stash near climate camp. BBC, Tuesday, 5th of August. A stash of knives and weapons has been found near the climate camp in Kent, police have said. Officers said the weapons, including a knife and a throwing star, were found in a wooded area on the Hoopen Peninsula on Monday evening. Protesters said the weapons were nothing to do with the camp and accused the police of a smear campaign.
That was an extract from an article published by the BBC early in the morning on Tuesday, the 5th of August. The Press Association, however, took it one step further, taking a claim by the police that the weapons were found near the climate camp site to the weapons were found at the climate campsite. Here is the article.
Weapons found at Eco Camp. Press Association, Tuesday, 5th August. Police are very, very worried about the intentions of a number of eco activists after a number of weapons were found at the site of an environmental protest camp, it was revealed. Speaking at a press conference, Assistant Chief Constable Gary Buttridge said that although the majority of protesters who have gathered at the Camp for Climate Action sites near Hoo, Kent, were law-abiding, he believed that around 150 of the 1,000 expected to have amassed by the end of the week had more sinister intentions. He made the comments after a number of weapons were seized and arrests were made at the site on Monday night. Standing in front of an assortment of weapons that have been confiscated so far, Mr. Buttridge said, "There is no justification whatsoever for having these weapons. I would suggest that a minority of people had hidden them with the intention of causing harm to police officers and possibly to the horses or dogs that we are using on patrol. And if you look at the equipment we have seized, it is clear to me the plan was to use these items for criminal purposes. We are very, very worried about the intentions of a number of hardcore protesters, which we believe are around 150, who are committed to using criminal means to achieve their aims."
The Press Association's smear does not go by unnoticed, but it is a very worrying development, as they are used as a supposedly reliable news source by media outlets around the world. This article, named "Climate Camp Attacked by Press Association Again," was published on UK in the media the same evening.
On Tuesday, the 5th of August, the Press Association ran an article under the heading "Weapons Found at Eco Camp." It must be more than coincidence that this is the second year running where the Press Association has actively set out to present climate camp protesters in a bad light by running outright lies. Last year, they sent out a release claiming that all the protesters at an action against the Israeli fresh produce importer Carmel Agretzko were drunk. The Sunday Times picked up the lie and ran with it, as did many local papers. The charge was refuted by the activists, and no one was ever charged for the action. This year, the police claimed on their website that they had found a stash of knives and makeshift weapons near climate camp protest site. The Press Association took this one step further by claiming that the weapons were actually found at the site. Whilst it isn't difficult to see why the police would want to link climate camp to the cache of arms found in a wood somewhere on the Hoo Peninsula, it's far more difficult to understand why the Press Association would feel the need to embellish an already incredulous story. Nick Davis in Flat Earth News notes the role of the Press Association in the emergence of journalism, where fewer and fewer journalists are required to produce more and more output, thus becoming heavily reliant on agencies such as Reuters and the Press Association for copy that they repackage in the style of their own papers. It is incidents such as these which makes it look as if he's missed the point. The Press Association is not a benign provider of impartial news, but has its own hidden agendas too. Of course, none of the smearing is new. Last year, the big one was the Evening Standard's front page story, Militants in Plot to Paralyse Heathrow, with its claim of fake bombs. This story resulted in a stinging rebuke for the paper from the Press Complaints Commission in March 2008. It's a tired old formula, used time and time again by the police to justify their expensive and useless policing, and time after time some august organ from the mainstream media plays the willing flag bearer. Whether the public is as gullible as the police and mainstream journalists like to think is quite a different question. Last night, Meridian reported that, because of the weapons found, massive convoys of police were making their way to the site from London and even Wales to be part of an operation estimated to cost £7.5 million. Strangely enough, that's what last year's operation at Heathrow cost. And chances are that this year will be another expensive waste of time with low-level charges, most of which don't lead to convictions, and a whole pile of confiscated crayons, wetsuits, tools, and plumbing pipes. Perhaps the public will pay attention for long enough to realise that the claims never come to anything. In any event, the 1,400 officers were announced well before the lucky find.
Our customers know that they can trust our reputation as a fast, fair and accurate source. The news as it happens, without spin. The Press Association.
Yeah, whatever.
Knives, makeshift weapons and bolt cutters, which Kent police say were seized near the so-called Camp for Climate Change outside Kingsdorth Power Station in North Kent, have been put on display today. But protesters who are against plans for a new coal-fired plant being built there claim the weapons don't belong to them and that the police are mounting a smear campaign. Our environment correspondent Mark Norman joins us live from the camp in Hoo. Violent clashes and arrests yesterday, now a war of words, Mark.
Yes, indeed, it's been another niggly day between protesters and police. In the last few minutes, the local MP, Bob Marshall-Andrews, has visited the site. He told us he finds the use of riot police here incomprehensible and that he's never felt less threatened than when he visited the camp behind me. But as you say, the day began with a police press conference where they put on display some knives and some of the material they've confiscated from protesters here. An extraordinary array of items put on display by police who believe they indicate how a hard core of camp protesters, they put the number at around 150 people, are intent on unlawful action.
You see here what is a very small array of what we've recovered during the course of searches at Climate Camp. The property you see ranges from bolt croppers to knives to fence cutters. We don't want to stop food going into the site. We don't want to stop essential material going into the site. However, we've got to strike a balance with ensuring that material, which you can see arrayed in front of you, doesn't go on there and cause a subsequent problem and end up getting somebody very seriously hurt or worse.
However, the protesters say knives, a throwing star and a chain found in woods nearby last night are not connected to them in any way or the other items that were put on display, all of which, they admit, were confiscated from people at the camp and might be used for direct action protests.
These are woods that are not on this site. They are not anywhere near us, and they claim to have found them, and they have made absolutely very clear that they have no evidence to link the fact that those knives were found and the fact that they were in any way from the site. So we are absolutely outraged that they are running with the fact that they are trying to pin this on us. There is no evidence to link the two. This is absolutely an outrageous attempt to have a smear on the climate camp, which they've been trying to do from day one.
This was the scene yesterday. Medway residents staying on the site overnight were so upset and annoyed at the police that they now intend to make an official complaint.
We saw some absolutely horrific use of force, an indiscriminate use of pepper spray on people who were just protesting peacefully at what they thought was an unjust action by the vast hordes of riot police that were up at the entrance.
And this is just day two of the protest designed to object to E.ON's plan to build a coal-fired power station at King's North. There are four more days to come, with a day of direct action planned at the power plant on Saturday.
Big differences between the two sides, Mark. How can they get a relationship back again?
Oh, a difficult one, Jeff, I think, especially with the day of protest coming up on Saturday. People here talk about police harassment and political policing. They say, for example, at midnight last night, the police helicopter was hovering over the site for some considerable time. I think their relationship is very tense at the moment and could get worse as we lead up to that day of action on Saturday, Jeff.
Mark, many thanks indeed.
That was the evening news on BBC South East yesterday evening. Even though the police is trying hard to put a spin on the media coverage, with stories of intended violence from the camp and such, the media continues to question their tactics, as this piece from Meridian TV shows.
Climate camp residents say they fear a repeat of the raids we saw by riot police yesterday, but Kent police deny that their actions were heavy-handed.
We believe what we did was appropriate. No confrontation was provoked by the police.
Kent police say they're determined to stop any attempt to close down King's North, which the protesters have vowed to do on Saturday. Well, as far as those scenes of the riot, spoke to the local MP here, that's Bob Marshall Andrews, who came back from holiday in Wales, presumably along with the convoy of police vehicles, to make his point of view. And this is what he told me just a few minutes ago.
This is not a place for riot police. I mean, these people, the nature of the people in there, they do not need control of that kind. And I thought that the scenes with riot police going in spoke for themselves. And I suspect an awful lot of people will feel that.
So will you be following this up? What will you be doing?
Well, I'm going now to see the liaison officer in Medway Police Station, and I hope the Gold Commander who is in charge, and I want very forcibly to get across my image and my feeling about what this camp is at the moment. Now, of course, I'm talking about the camp. I'm not talking about future protests or anything else. I'm talking about this organisation here. And this organisation here, I would have thought sending in riot police is going to make enemies of precisely the people who the police need as their friends.
Right. This is the end of today's media review. A big thanks to Doug for providing us with most of the media coverage and FTP for the In the Media article recording. Please note that all the reports and articles were edited down. I'll leave you with some stuff from BBC Kent Radio this morning. See you tomorrow for some more media review. Until then, take care and sleep well.
Kent Police's use of force at the climate camp near King's North has been labelled incomprehensible by the local MP. Medway's Bob Marshall Andrews held talks last night with police about his concerns. He's been to the camp and says he's never felt less threatened by the protesters. The Kent Force says it's committed to policing lawful protests and won't hesitate to enforce the law where necessary. So far, there have been around a dozen arrests with various items confiscated. Matt Mason from the camp isn't happy.
Environmentalists, nobody here has any intention or agenda of wanting to harm or even to jeopardise the safety of anybody, the police, the E.ON workers or any of us.
Vita, for giving us that media digest and review for tonight. And now we're on to the entertainment segment of our evening. And I'm sitting here with two musicians from Bolivia who will be playing some roots music for us. If you could introduce yourselves.
I'm Nayel.
I'm Marisol.
And you're from the group?
Kurumi Suriki.
And so take it away. Would you like to play another song for us, perhaps? Or?
Yes, we'd like to play one.
Okay.
If it's possible.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I will just wanted to say that something personal. I just wanted to dedicate this song right now, or these songs, to a friend, a family of a friend, that's a child that in this family, and just be with them in soul and mind and spirit. Just this, like, this music is a soul and spirit, and from the earth and from us. Everything. Thank you.
Yeah.
Excellent. That was wicked. Thank you very much. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Our pleasure.
I don't know if wicked's often a term you hear to describe that type of music, but I like it a lot. All right.
Yes, and yeah.
I think could I repeat
actually
some of that.
This instrument is to call the rain.
This instrument is to call the rain.
Let's hope, dude. It doesn't.
I sincerely hope you're a rubbish player.
This is before the rain, the time before the rain. We play this instrument in the time before the rain. So the season. No?
Have you got a sunny whistle as well?
Sorry.
Have you got one to make the sunshine?
Not now, I think. But all of them.
Maybe tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Repeat some of this the performance again later this evening, I think, or perhaps.
Yeah, we didn't. Well, we came here like not very well organized, but yeah, we can.
So you're going to be playing later on tonight, I hope.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
We'll do it then.
That's sweet. So anybody on site, if they want to catch that tonight, they can catch that probably in like the big tent, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Dancing version.
Yes.
Lights and stuff. It'd be wicked. Oh, it's really nice stuff. So, next up, we're going to have some...
Yeah, the Carbontown Crier with friend, a saxophonist named Andy.
Andy plus friend. So, do you do this once some microphones or stuff?
Yeah, how should we hold
it? It's not really very live.
We're low-tech in here, and we don't have lots of stands, so we've got people, though.
Okay, well, I can sit down over there by
the
mic. Great.
Sweet. Okay.
Hey, don't need much mic for me.
Come on over here.
And we may well be joined at some point by the drone of a throbbing helicopter accompaniment.
Oh, yes, our friends in the sky.
It's more moving because of the appalling racket above.
I think Frank Zappa and Schoenberg would be proud of us.
Cool. Right, so I'm going to have a sit beside you here and mic you up. And so please be nice to me.
That sounds delightful. I hope that I can be nice to you without using words, just with my physical presence.
Better be a good song, dude.
Do you want to say anything about what we're going to do?
What should we do? Should we do my song first?
Okay. Well, this is a song
which I wrote a couple weeks ago in the delightful surroundings of Embercombe down in Devon. Which was a sort of inspiring place. And, I think it says it all, but it seems appropriate here. And
we sang it. When did we last sing it?
We sang it on Monday morning up at the front gate, the back gate, the front line, I'm thinking of, to an audience, a mixed audience, shall we say,
yes,
of participants sitting on the floor and joining in.
Raggle-taggle riot cops.
Yes, kind of restraining themselves. Because it was obviously...
Restraining themselves from tapping along.
Yeah, yes.
Like those shields, just like little plastic, big plastic barons, aren't they?
That's right, yeah.
No, I just see one guy tapping on his chest and making a bit of a beat. Okay, do you want to set it up there?
Is that right?
And this has at the end of it, it has a chorus which everyone in this studio can join in with, and Mark will be leading you in that, and you can carry on with that as a ostinato, I think would be the technical term, and I'll sing over the top. I'm a one-match fire, burning bright, and gonna take you to a place of pure delight, to a world where we can sing our song in front of everyone. To a land that's free of bigotry, full of tolerance and love and harmony. The struggle never ends to be better men, but we're doing it together for a common end. We're doing it together, everybody. We're doing it together.
Yeah, we're doing it together.
We're doing it together. I'm a one-match fire that's burning bright. I'm gonna take you to a place of pure delight, to a world where we can sing our song in front of everyone. It's a world that's free of bigotry, full of tolerance and love and harmony. Struggle never ends to be better men, but we're doing it together for a common end. We're doing it together. Yeah, we're doing it together.
Doing it together.
Yeah, doing it together. Ooh, we're doing it together. Doing it together. Doing it together. Oh, we're doing it together. 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 Yeah. Doing it together. Yeah, we're doing it together. We're doing it together. Doing it together. Doing it together.
Bright, I'm gonna take you to a place of pure delight, to a land where we can sing our song in front of everyone. It's a world that's free of bigotry. It's full of love and tolerance and harmony. The struggle never ends to be better men. We're doing it together for a common end. We're doing it together. We're doing it together. We're doing it together. We're doing it again. Doing it, yeah.
You guys are lovely.
Cool.
That was dead nice.
Nice.
Well, is it time for another little soup song? How's time?
We got another one lined up for us, dude.
We do. Well, I've been doing it on The Voice, as you might have noticed. Carbontown and Croker. But I was just picking around on the gate duty today at the front and came up with a little something. A little something, you know. And it goes a bit like this. Are we alright? Where are we? Let's change up to there. There we go. Future may not be so clear. At least we're making history round here. Yeah, the future may not be so clear. Yeah, at least we're making history round here. Yeah, the future looks a little dark. At least I'm floating in my climate camp park. All right, floating in my climate camp park. Oh, yeah. Oh, 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 yeah, yeah, yeah. Future look a little darker than I'm born. At least we're making history around here. Future look a little dark. At least we're making floating in the climate camp park. Oh, yeah, carrying a spark. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're putting out the fossil fires and keeping ours burning. Yeah, we're putting out the fossil fuel fires and keeping ours burning. Yeah, putting out the fossil fuel fires and keeping ours burning. Yeah, putting out the fossil fuel fires and keeping ours burning. And the future looks a little dark. At least I'm sailing down the Medway in the climate camp.
Excellent.
Hey. Like it, dude. How come I haven't got an invite to this climate camp bar yet, though? Oh, I didn't. Arc! I have. I've had a long day, you know, and I went for a beer earlier, and somebody handed me this really warm bottle of beer, and I was like, let's actually hand it back.
Wow.
Warm beer. It is.
Fridges are one thing that are in short supply around here.
Don't let me plug it.
Dark. The future looks a little dark. At least we're sailing along in the climate camp.
I was thinking dark beer. Okay, and they won't let me. And they won't let me plug my fridge into the 12-volt system. What's going on?
Oh, I wonder why.
There's going to be mojitos. There will be, going back to the theme of the Latin American night, there will be mojitos available this evening, allegedly. Alcohol-free mojitos not being sold on site.
How are you going to get the ice up here, man? That's clearly a dangerous weapon of pleasure and entertainment.
You know? Just dream on, baby. Don't leave it to Eon. Just dream on.
Alright, cool. So are you playing tonight, Mark, at all?
No, I'm shot to pieces. I'm not Latin American. Let's have some real rhythms and dances. We've got Radio Revolucion playing in the main place with Movimientos DJs. They popped in earlier and then popped out. I hope they're alright. And Bolivian Dances and Surprises. I must say, I thought that was the most overwhelming thing they just did.
Very
especially
beautiful.
With the helicopters overhead, and it was such a delicate sound, and there's this brutal, appalling sound over their heads. It was very moving.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks to both of you for coming in.
Oh,
really appreciate
Thank
it. Some
so
wicked
much.
Tunes there. Maybe you'll drop back in on us again at some stage.
Yeah, well, we're rounding up. There's so much talent in this site. You keep thinking you've reached the end, but then you find a whole new strata.
Really?
So we're just rounding them, wheeling them in and reading them in. But one thing I would like to say briefly is that we're looking at going out on the Orange Block on Saturday. And we're looking to put together a really shit... I'm using that rude word again. I used that last night.
You did.
An amazing block of movers, singers, and musicians. We want a really nice marching band out there on Saturday. So that's the call out. If you're out there, if you're in here, come to the Orange Block meeting tomorrow at 2, or just keep your eyes open for notices. Or if you're out there in Radio Land, get yourselves down here as soon as you can, because we need to make the streets of Who... rock and sway on Saturday.
Cool. So you'll be cool. holding auditions to make sure any musicians who come along are actually good, though,
that's
yeah?
That's right. Auditions will be held at 3 a.m. this morning.
Okay.
If you can bring your own riot shields, come Baran, you're in.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in again.
All right. Well, listen, thanks again to the lads for a bit of tunes there. And... as Mark referred to those out in Radio Land, a lot of you have probably come across us through Indie Media, who Indie Media UK are giving us a lot of love. Just want to say thanks to them for promoting
Yay.
The show.
Wiggly hands.
And of course, there's quite a few of us who are doing it, but we heard about us already.
Yeah.
So we're going to finish up now, but we got a guy here who wants to quickly plug something. So everyone, are you ready? Shh. Shh. Climate Camp Radio.
Climate Camp Radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. My name is Callum Simpson. I'm from an organisation called Movimientos, and we do cultural events linked with solidarity relating to Latin America, mm-hmm. and combine music, political film, documentary screenings with live music, and a different slant on Latin American music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, trying to provide some alternative to the mainstream Latin scene, as yes. well as providing a platform for Latin American groups that were here today, Colombia Solidarity Campaign, mm-hmm. Bolivia Solidarity Campaign, mm-hmm. The Ecuador Group, the Hands of Venezuela, and these are the people that have been the core of our following, and the idea is to expand out towards and to give these groups a bigger platform, and the issues in Latin America. And in the last few months, we've had a lot of focus on the two things that were mainly interesting me was the environment. We've had some films, we had some specials on Latin America and the environment, and there's plenty more to come. And also the indigenous movement the situation with the indigenous people in Latin America, and which ties in very strongly with the environment, because obviously the indigenous people are the ones that can teach us a lot about how to live with nature and live with this earth and how to coexist with each other. And those are the most marginalized people in Latin America. And there'll be a festival called the Native Spirit Festival, which we're supporting, happening in October. And then tonight...
It won't be very warm in October. There'll be nothing like South America.
Well, yeah. but we'll do it in a nice, warm, inside venue. Nice, warm venues.
Okay.
And we'll make it hot with some good music. So,
yeah.
Where
is this thing on?
Native Spirit is going to be a film festival, which is going to be in October. So, but
where?
In London. Sorry, I'm not... I'm thinking London-centric, yeah. Movimientos does monthly live Latin music night and also a documentary film night, which is happening tomorrow, which is why sadly I have to go home in Angel. So if you're listening, and where we show documentary films and blah blah, as I explained before.
Okay.
So yeah, that's what we're doing. And tonight, the main reason I'm here is to plug. Sorry, I've just waffled on. But Tonight we're doing a special performance by the Bolivian group who performed earlier, did a workshop earlier. Todos Bolivia, I think. I can't remember the name. And Radio Revolucion, Latin reggae, ska, revolution rock.
Good
from
stuff.
From London.
In the camp tonight?
Yeah,
in where the camp tonight. Up in the main tent.
Yeah.
So everybody listening got to get down. Yeah, if you're in the local area, then come down to Climate Camp, say hello.
Well, thank you for dropping by and letting us know.
I think we might even have a tune lined up on number two, which is something to finish on, maybe, the show.
Yeah.
So I'll let you discover what it is. It's a remix from someone quite famous and someone who supports all these movements. And
if it's Sting, I'm turning it off.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for having
signing me off tonight.
Cheers.
Alan, did you come in with a mojito?
Politics need ignorance. Politics need lies.